It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here. We're in conversation with the new president of Lawrence College in Appleton about pressing issues facing higher ed. Here's some roadmap for discussion, how to create an environment where first generation and underrepresented students are supported and they thrive. We'll look at the impact of the pandemic on university budgets and enrollment. Student debt, also a huge issue. Loan forgiveness amid soaring inflation. And we start with the impact of a liberal arts education and its place in higher ed. Join in along the way, 800-642-1234. Lori Carter is the 17th president of Lawrence University, previously served as president of Shippensburg University in Pennsylvania, and has held leadership posts at Eastern Kentucky University and the Juilliard School. President Lori Carter, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, let's start with what is near and dear to you, and that is liberal arts. Tell us, what is valuable about a liberal arts education?
Well, what isn't valuable about it? Students who attend liberal arts institutions have the opportunity to stretch and grow in ways that really doesn't happen at all institutions. There is a core curriculum that really steeps them in the ability to think critically, to work well in teams, to be able to communicate effectively. So writing and public speaking, interacting in teams is all a part of the experience. And that's why so many leaders of corporations, of not-for-profit organizations, and of higher learning have been steeped in the liberal arts. It really does give you a toolkit that prepares you for all sorts of leadership experiences in life, and also prepares you to be a lifelong learner.
And full disclosure, I am the product of that toolkit of a public liberal arts education. But, you know, we've heard the criticisms over the decades that the degree isn't worth the money, that you learn the soft skills and how to be that critical thinker, the writing, as you mentioned, but not the technical skills, not that hands-on skills that make you more employable. How do you respond to critics who challenge the true worth of the degree?
So let's talk about hands-on skills and how you learn them, really. When you think about programs that are really hands-on and focused in a way that doesn't give you the broad swath that the liberal arts does, there's tension there about folks who have technical skills, but then don't have the ability to problem solve effectively or work well with teams. So it's all important. And it's not as though you don't learn some of those skills in the liberal arts education. At Lawrence, for instance, we work very hard to place our students in internships, in job shadowing, mentoring opportunities. So they're really learning how to gain those technical skills while also benefiting from the wealth of experience of a liberal arts education.
President Carter, how do you think the pandemic has changed the job prospects for liberal arts graduates?
Oh, gosh, the pandemic has changed so much about how we live, hasn't it?
Mm.
I think it's important to think about the liberal arts in the context of everything else that's going on in our society. So the pandemic has caused folks to think about how they live and work differently. It has really inspired people to seek more balance in life. And at the same time, it has brought out the need for employers to be more sensitive to mental health issues. The liberal arts is really kind of addressing those issues already. I mean, we produce graduates who are really able to balance things well, who are able to think through the problems of today. So Job prospects for liberal arts graduates should be better than ever before because it is the liberal arts graduate who is well prepared to succeed in the workplace.
We're talking with Lawrence University's new president, Lori Carter, about issues in liberal arts, about issues facing higher ed, and what you have experienced. 800-642-1234 to join in. You are the product of a first generation in your family to receive a college degree. What difference has that made in your life?
It's made a tremendous difference in my life. You know, my parents both, after raising their children, went back and got college degrees, which really speaks to the value of a college degree, even for people like my father, who had to drop out of school in the seventh grade to help support his family. But while he did that and then raised his own family, he knew that a college education was important. And so he obtained that degree and then started teaching. And he taught at a technical college. So there you go. How all of the skills matter, and how education is transformative. For me, it has really changed not just my life, but the life of my entire family. And for those who are coming behind me to see what higher education has been able to do in my life, I think it really serves as motivation and inspiration for them. It really is a game changer.
Do you think campuses are correctly supporting first generation students? What could they do differently?
Oh, I think some do it really well, and some are working on it. And at Lawrence, we are doing it well, but we're getting better and better at it. First generation college students don't know what they don't know, as they say. And so it's important to have an infrastructure that allows them to fill in those gaps. And that means having folks around who are providing extra safety nets. At Lawrence, we have a group of faculty and staff who were first gen, who serve as additional support and mentors to our first generation population. We have a program designed just for those students so that they can be together and share stories. Because sometimes when you are first gen, you don't want to feel as though you're not as savvy as some others who perhaps aren't first gen. So it's nice to have other first gens to talk with these things about, to bounce things off of families. Our engagement with families is very intentional because we understand that it is that pull to home that sometimes causes students to struggle. And so we want families to know that they too are a part of the Lawrence community.
And there's so much at stake, right? I mean, you look at student debt in our country, 43 million Americans holding $1.6 trillion in student loan debt. What debt relief would you like to see President Biden's administration offer these borrowers?
So debt relief is a really tricky issue. And when you think about the big number of debt, you really have to look at where that debt comes from. A lot of it is coming from for-profit institutions. It's even coming from higher learning, medical school, law school debt. And so the Biden administration has to think very carefully about what kind of debt relief should be available to people and why. You know, I was a first gen student who worked my way through college, and I took out debt for college. And I was great. I'm grateful I was able to pay it off. But I think making an investment in my education was not a terrible thing for me to do. Yet at the same time, I had a manageable amount of debt. And that's what we want to see. We want to see students making an investment in their education, but being able to afford to pay off that debt in a reasonable amount of time so they can move on with their lives. And that's what we're doing at Lawrence. We are really working towards becoming an institution that's focused on full need. We're very close to being full need, particularly for students coming from the state of Wisconsin. And what we're seeing as a result of that is a great reduction in the amount of debt students have to take out. And that's what institutions should be working towards. Yes, it would be wonderful for the Biden administration to provide some support and some relief. Yet institutions have to really get engaged in this process of appropriate pricing, appropriate discount rates, and really focusing on the students who need access to higher education from a financial standpoint so that it is available to everyone.
Lawrence University President Lori Carter, the first person of color to lead the institution, with us for her perspective on a range of issues hitting higher ed. Carter was inaugurated in May. Join in on the challenges and opportunities of a liberal arts education, race-based disparities, the work of racial equity in higher ed. We'll get to that. How Wisconsin cities can work with their local universities and be a strong community partner. Join in, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Lawrence University President Lori Carter, who, as we've been talking about, was a first-generation college student herself, a trailblazer of firsts here, including first person of color to lead Lawrence in its 175-year history. Join in on liberal arts, issues facing universities in Wisconsin, racial equity work on campus, and more. 800-642-1234. President Lori Carter stays with us. President Carter, the murder of George Floyd in 2020 reignited, as you saw, protests against American racism, especially on college campuses. How should universities be engaging in this conversation?
Well, the really interesting thing is that universities were engaging in this conversation prior to the murder of George Floyd. And after the event, really in earnest, started looking at how they were engaging in those conversations, how meaningful those conversations had been, and have responded in a way that I think is really admirable. Stepping up to say, we weren't having these conversations in the ways that were changing how folks were responding, and now really moving to a space where, like at Lawrence, we're doing work not just in DEIA, but also in anti-racism. So how can universities really prepare students to go out into society to challenge conventional thinking in some ways, but also to be leaders in discussion and solutions?
Can you be more specific there? How is Lawrence addressing racism on its campus?
Sure. Well, we have a chief diversity officer who's a vice president level, and that person really works across campus. We went through a process this year, something we called a guiding coalition, where a group of about 30 faculty, staff, and students spent several months looking at where we are in terms of our DEIA efforts and where we need to be. And so they put forth some recommendations that we are working through. Most of them have to do with really creating an environment where everyone has a strong sense of belonging and there is a culture of inclusion. And so hiring more faculty and staff of color, really understanding that students from different cultural backgrounds need different levels of supports. One of the things we just completed a project, for instance, of making sure that our admissions materials are translated into Spanish. Mm. We have, over 10% of our students come from the Latinx community, and we want their families to be able to understand the process, particularly since many of them are also first gen. So it's things like that we're being very intentional about. My entire cabinet and I meet on a term basis with the student organizations that support diverse students. And we have really frank dialogue about where we are and where we need to go. So we have opened up communication and dialogue. We are very intentional about supporting student events and student ideas. About working with faculty and staff on their needs, helping as we're hiring people from diverse backgrounds, making sure that when they move into the community, they're connected with people from communities that matter to them and have the opportunity to participate in activities that are maybe important to them and their families. Really listening to people and then responding in a way that allows them to have a stronger sense of belonging.
Mm, thank you for so many examples there. Lori Carter with us, president of Lawrence University in Appleton. You can share in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Andrew is joining us from Whitewater now. Andrew, what would you like to bring up?
Hi there. I'd just like to mention that when I graduated high school, this was back in 2010, at that time, a lot of my high school teachers were saying if you didn't go to college and get a four-year degree, that you weren't going to be able to have a successful career or a fruitful life following high school. And I think that ties into why there's been such an explosion in student loan debt. But on the issue of debt relief, one thing I can't understand, and this is somebody who went to college, I can't understand why it is my neighbor who may have went to a trade school, why they should be on the hook for my student loan debt when it was a decision that I had made to take on.
Andrew, thank you for that. President Carter, how do you respond to that?
Well, as I said earlier, I think that any debt relief that is delivered by the federal government really has to be thought through very carefully. Mm. And there has to be a thoughtful process and real rationale for it. I am certainly not a proponent of just relieving debt for everyone, because I do think that making an investment in your education is important. Mm. But in cases where there has been abuse, then perhaps that is appropriate. But those are complex issues.
Even before the pandemic, a number of private liberal arts schools had already made these really wrenching budget cuts, curriculum changes. Some made complete overhauls of their liberal arts programs. How do you approach cutting programs versus keeping a healthy budget outlook versus keeping the core of what you see as liberal arts?
Right. Well, so first of all, Lawrence is committed to the liberal arts tradition. And if you're a liberal arts institution, there is a certain core. There is a certain foundation that you would like for all students to have. And that can be done in a sustainable way. There are a variety of levers that institutions have to pull about program array, about student enrollment numbers, that all are part of the decision-making process. But For those of us who believe in the liberal arts, you can do that within the context of balancing a budget. It just has to be done in a way that allows us to continue the tradition of the liberal arts, but also respond to the needs of today's students and parents. So it's a balance, and it requires a great deal of conversation and compromise, but it is possible.
President Carter, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Kate. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Yes. Lori Carter, president of Lawrence University. And for disclosure, Lawrence University is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio. Ahead this hour, we talk with Wisconsin's attorney general about how the state might use the more than $400 million Wisconsin is slated to receive from the opioid settlement. Join in, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin will receive over $400 million from a massive multi-state settlements. Four pharmaceutical companies, manufacturer in the mix that allegedly misled patients and physicians about the addictive nature of opioids. Millions of dollars from the settlements are starting to flow into our state. Join in on the opioid crisis and where this money should go. 800-642-1234. Josh Call is Attorney General of Wisconsin. Welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
So earlier this month, Wisconsin received its first $6 million from the National Prescription Opioid Litigation Settlement. We'll, as you have said before, we'll receive nearly $31 million throughout the remainder of this year. So is this fair and appropriate compensation for what has come from the opioid epidemic?
You know, Kate, I don't think we can ever recover as much money as we really need to address the impacts of the opioid epidemic. The communities across the state of Wisconsin and families across the state of Wisconsin have been devastated by this epidemic over the course of decades. And the harm that to Wisconsinites and to our communities is just enormous. What we've been committed to at the Wisconsin Department of Justice and in my administration has been to do everything we can to hold the opioid companies accountable for their role in this epidemic. And so we filed suit against Purdue Pharma, which manufactured OxyContin and helped usher in the epidemic. We also joined investigations, multi-state investigations into opioid distributors. And we have systematically been working to secure recoveries for the state of Wisconsin that can go to communities across the state to support efforts to fight this epidemic. And so we recovered over $10 million from McKinsey, the consulting company, for its involvement in promoting opioids. We have this massive multi-state settlement you mentioned, which is going to result in over $400 million coming to Wisconsin. And we're pursuing other recoveries as well from opioid companies. And I think there's going to be additional funds on top of this $400 million we've been talking about coming to the state. We're still working on that. So our goal is to maximize what we recover for Wisconsin so that we can use those funds to do as much good and do as much to fight the epidemic as we can.
What I'm hearing is that there will be more settlements to come.
I think that's very likely. We for example, recently announced that two companies that manufacture opioids, Allergan and Teva, have gotten tentative resolutions. Those two resolutions nationwide would be over $6 billion. And so that would be another significant amount of money coming to Wisconsin. There are a few companies in bankruptcy, and specifically Purdue Pharma and Mallinckrodt. Again, that would lead to tens of millions of dollars coming to Wisconsin. And we're not done there either. We are going to keep aggressively pursuing recoveries from companies that were involved in false or misleading or deceptive communications about the benefits and the harms of opioids, so that we can maximize our recovery and get resources to folks.
On these huge multi-state lawsuits, how much Wisconsin resources need to be contributed into the collective legal fight, if you will? How do states manage that workload and the costs associated with prosecuting and getting to these settlements?
We have a long history of AGs across the country working together collaboratively in a bipartisan fashion on multi-state investigations and sometimes multi-state lawsuits. And the opioid cases are, I think, a really great example of how effectively states can work together. We have done it in a bipartisan fashion, and there are some cases where Wisconsin's role is very large. And so, for example, on the Teva case I mentioned, we are part of the executive committee. That's sort of the group that leads the effort to hold the company accountable. And in some of the other cases, we've just been a normal member of the multi-state review and investigation. So in different cases, different states sort of play a leadership role, and everybody comes to these cases with the attitude that we're all going to pitch in and do our share. Here in the opioid cases as well, many counties and municipal governments around the country have been involved. So in Wisconsin, 71 of our 72 counties had filed the suit, and a number of cities did as well. And so we've also worked together with counties and local governments as we've worked to move forward in these cases. The cost shares get distributed among the states so that everybody's sort of putting up their fair share. The recoveries we're talking about here far, far, far exceed the expense of state resources in these cases.
With an eye on the country, then, last month, a federal judge in West Virginia ruled in favor of three of the drug companies, saying they were not responsible for causing, quote, a public nuisance through the distribution of opioids. What impact does that ruling have on the already agreed upon settlements?
Well, first, if there is a settlement that's been agreed upon, that resolves the case. And so this, the $400 million that's going to be coming to the state, that's been finalized. And, okay, those funds are coming. Now, with ongoing matters, any sort of court ruling could potentially impact the way that another court approaches one of these cases. But there have been a number of cases as well where these have moved forward to trial. So in Oklahoma, for example, there was a trial held, and we're very confident that if these cases were to go to trial, we would succeed. And so I expect that we're not going to see an impact in terms of our ability to get opioid companies either to agree to a resolution or, if we need to move forward to trial and hold the companies accountable that way.
Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call with us as we talk about opioid settlement funds and where they go, the future of these settlements, the work involved in prosecuting pharmaceutical companies and manufacturers. You can join in 800-642-1234. The Department of Health Services, DHS, plans to spend Wisconsin's share of the opioid litigation settlement. Where will the funds make the most difference? How will you dispense these funds as they come into our state?
Under the state law that was passed last year, 70% of the recovery from these opioid cases goes to counties and local governments in Wisconsin that have been litigating those cases. And then the other 30% goes to the Department of Health Services in Wisconsin. And so this year, that's going to mean about $31 million going to the Department of Health Services to support efforts to fight the opioid epidemic. Now, at the counties and municipal level, each county and municipality can make their own decisions about how to spend those resources. There are some parameters in the settlement agreement, but the main point is that they need to go towards fighting the opioid epidemic, and each county and each municipality can decide how they want to spend those funds. At the state level, the Department of Health Services has created a process for putting together a plan for how they're going to spend the resources that they receive. They've held listening sessions. They've been reaching out to people. And they've proposed a multifaceted plan, which I think is the exact right way to go about doing this, because we've got to address this epidemic comprehensively. So they've proposed investments in things that can immediately prevent harm from opioids, and that includes additional funding for Narcan to help reverse overdoses, mm-hmm. Additional funding for fentanyl test strips, which have been shown to save lives. They're also proposing investments in prevention efforts to address root causes and to reduce the number of folks who become addicted to opioids. And then they've also proposed investments in things that can help with treatment and recovery. And so that includes capital projects and also projects that would help provide wraparound services for people who are struggling with substance use disorder. Now, that plan needs to be approved by the Joint Finance Committee. That's a legislative committee. And so having that go into effect is going to depend on what the legislature does.
And I'm wondering, too, as you put that state-level plan together, how much will you lean on the grant method of distribution, where organizations that are fighting, you know, this opioid addiction crisis, those wraparound organizations, that they would need to apply to get at these funds?
In terms of the, you know, how the funds are being distributed, ultimately, that is the Department of Health Services call. Again, state law provides for them to distribute those funds. Mm-hmm. You know, what we have done at DOJ is a couple of things. First, we're the ones who are tasked with making sure we're holding those opioid companies accountable and securing those resources for the state of Wisconsin. We've done that. And where we think we can provide helpful comments to supplement how the Department of Health Services is going about doing the work that it's doing. We're doing so and trying to identify key problems. The folks at the Department of Health Services, they've really got the expertise in public health and how we can most effectively and efficiently distribute those funds to get them to communities. So how they ultimately decide to balance, grant making versus, you know, direct payments to different facilities is going to be a decision that, that they're going to use their judgment as public health experts to make. But often with these kinds of government programs where there are a lot of resources, you'll see a grant process so that the strongest applications or the best ideas are able to be selected through a fair process.
We're talking about the latest in state litigation efforts with the head of the State Justice Department, Attorney General Josh Call, on the line. Join in on opioid settlements on the abortion ban case. Forever chemical lawsuits targeting 18 companies and other state lawsuits that are on your mind. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. We're in conversation with Attorney General Josh Call on the pressing issues before the State Justice Department and the latest developments in state litigation. Join in 800-642-1234. The Attorney General is with us for about 10 more minutes. Attorney General Call, last month your office filed a lawsuit against three Wisconsin manufacturers, 15 other defendants for PFAS contamination, Forever Chemicals. And I'm wondering, how is this case similar or different to lawsuits against the makers and distributors of opioids, or before that, Big Tobacco?
You know, I think there are a lot of similarities between this new suit regarding PFAS companies and the investigations with opioid manufacturers. What we have alleged in this lawsuit is that a number of companies were involved in the marketing, manufacture, sale of PFAS, and that they knew for years in some cases that PFAS were cancer-causing chemicals that had other serious negative health impacts on people, and that they shielded that information from the public so that people would not become aware of the dangers of PFAS. And across the state of Wisconsin now, we are seeing the impacts of PFAS contamination. Marinette is a great example where for years there were PFAS chemicals that were going into the water, and there's significant PFAS contamination there and remediation that needs to happen. But Marinette is definitely not alone across the state. There are a number of other communities from Rhinelander to La Crosse to Madison that have been impacted. And what we are seeking to do with that suit is make sure that the companies responsible for PFAS contamination clean it up, and that the cost of those cleanups are borne by the companies that profited from selling PFAS and not Wisconsin taxpayers.
Do you see potential for a suit like this to become a multi-state suit? Because PFAS know no boundaries. They cut across state lines. We're seeing them all over the country.
What has happened with these cases is somewhat similar to what happened with some of the opioid cases, which is that there is a multi-state litigation that a number of these cases have been brought into. We're going to have litigation ahead of us on whether this case moves forward as a Wisconsin-specific case or as a case that gets pulled into that multi-state. I want to move forward with this case, and so it's my hope that it is resolved in Wisconsin because there are harms that are very specific to communities in Wisconsin, and I think being able to make sure that case moves quickly rather than gets delayed in a big, massive multi-state process is in the best interest of Wisconsinites. But it certainly is possible that there would be negotiations or discussions among many states, just as there were with opioids. There also have been some places in the country where there have been settlements already. So the state of Minnesota, for example, years ago brought an action and recovered substantial amounts of money. So how that all unfolds, I think, will depend on what courts decide about how these cases move forward. But regardless of how it unfolds, we're going to keep pursuing recovery so that taxpayers aren't left footing the bill for pollution that these companies have caused.
I want to turn to the abortion ban case. The lawsuit in your case, you know, named Senate President Chris Kapinga, Senate Majority Leader Devin LeMahieu, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss as defendants. There is, as of course you know, the deadline has been extended on this case. Is this the strategy to force the Republican-controlled legislature to act on taking this law off the books? What is your strategy here?
Well, straightforward strategy here is that we believe that the 19th century ban on almost all abortions, which contains no exception for cases of rape or incest, and only allows for an abortion to save the life of the mother, but not one to prevent serious harm to the health of the mother, we believe that that ban has not gone into effect. It remains in the books, but there were subsequently a number of laws passed that regulate lawful abortions, and those two sets of laws are fundamentally inconsistent with each other. And the legal principle that applies usually is that the more recent laws are the ones that are enforced. So our hope is that courts will agree with that understanding of the law and block the enforcement of this draconian 19th century ban. Now, these three Republican legislators are going to respond to that complaint that we filed here in court, and we'll see if they want to stand by this draconian ban. That's the indication we have so far from public comments. But this case will ultimately decide whether we restore access to safe and legal abortion in Wisconsin or not. Now, the most direct route to do that would be for the legislature just to meet, pass legislation repealing that 19th century ban, and that would resolve any doubt about this. But so far, the Republican-led legislature has been unwilling to do that. They want to keep this draconian ban with no exceptions for rape or incest in place, even after the governor called a special session, the Republicans, rather than addressing this, just gabbled in and gabbled out. So there are a couple ways we can change this, but based on the inaction we've seen legislatively, the courts appear to be the best route right now.
Talking with Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call online, you can join in 800-642-1234. I want to turn now to the statewide sexual assault kit tracking system that you had launched, I think, in June, thereabouts, allowing sexual assault survivors to track the location of their kit through the testing process. How is this new system working?
It's gone really smoothly. You know, anytime you launch a new technology, there's usually concerns about how implementation is going to go and how smoothly the rollout is. And it's been really great to see this process working very smoothly. We before we launched this statewide, we did a pilot program with some specific agencies so that law enforcement and others could test out how the system would work and use it. And the statewide rollout has gone smoothly. And this is really transforming the way that survivors of sexual assault are able to get information about their cases, because previously there was no statewide system for tracking this. And so often if somebody in the process, a law enforcement officer or a victim services professional, would just reach out and affirmatively try to contact a victim to give them an update. But that could be when somebody is at work. It could be when they're at a kid's soccer game. And it may not be the time when the survivor wants to have that conversation. Now we've put survivors really in charge of the process of when they get information, because there's a simple barcode that that a survivor can use to log in, get the information about the status of their kit, and it provides contact information so that if they want to get further information, they can do that at a time of their choosing. And so far, the process has gone really smoothly. The feedback we've heard has been very positive. And so this is a real significant improvement we've made in our response to sexual assault in Wisconsin.
The state's crime lab in the past has seen significant delays with DNA analysis. Are there backlogs that still need addressing?
One of the things we've worked to do over the last several years is to reduce the number of cases that are pending, particularly cases that are pending for over 60 or 90 days waiting for testing. My first year in office, we saw a pretty stark reduction in the number of cases that fell into that category. Now, when the pandemic hit, which impacted the way the crime lab was able to do its work, we saw those numbers go up for a bit. But we've again reversed that trend. And again, those cases are trending downward. So the path that we're on in terms of the number of cases that need to be tested that have been waiting for more than 60 or 90 days is a positive one. And so I think we are well positioned for future success there. That being said, we need to keep investing in the crime labs because number one, the number of submissions we receive is going to keep being significant. And number two, the process that DNA analysts go through has gotten more complex over time. And that's a really positive thing because it means that we are able to solve more cases than we used to be able to solve. And we can identify DNA in more complex mixtures than we used to be able to. But it also means that there's more time intensiveness to each individual case and each individual analysis. And so continuing to invest in our crime labs is an investment in public safety and our justice system in Wisconsin. And I hope that we will continue to see that moving forward.
Attorney General Josh Call, thank you for joining us. Thanks for the conversation.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Josh Call is Attorney General for the state of Wisconsin. And just ahead, we learn about a bicycle-based beekeeping business in western Wisconsin. Join in on beekeeping. Your questions, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.